You hear it before you see it. That sound, low and growling at first, then rising to a howl as it pulls up off the deck. If you've ever stood at an air show when a Merlin engine goes to full power on a climbing pass, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Your chest feels it before your ears register it. It's not just noise, it's something older than noise, something that reaches into your gut and says, "This machine matters." I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Pull up a chair, because today we're talking about the Supermarine Spitfire. Not just what it was, not the specs and the kill ratios, what it cost to build it, who paid the price, and why 80-some years after the last one rolled off the line, pilots still stop talking when one goes overhead. The Spitfire didn't begin as a military necessity. It began as a racing obsession. Back in the 1920s and early 30s, the Schneider Trophy race was the Formula One of aviation. Nations sent their best engineers and their national pride to compete in floatplane and seaplane contests over a triangular watercourse, chasing pure speed. Britain fielded entries through a company called Supermarine Aviation Works, based in Southampton. And the man running the engineering show was Reginald Joseph Mitchell, R.J. Mitchell. Everyone called him by his initials. Mitchell was a Staffordshire man, working-class background, technical school education, not the Oxford type. He joined Supermarine as a draftsman in 1916 when he was 20 years old. By 1919, he was chief designer. He was not yet 24. His Schneider Trophy machines were breathtaking. The S5 and 27, the S6 and 29, the S6B and 31. Sleek, gorgeous floatplanes with enormous Rolls-Royce engines buried in narrow fuselages, cooling radiators pressed flush into the float surfaces and the wing skins to wring out every knot they could. Racing shapes, the S6B won the Schneider Trophy outright in 1931, became the first aircraft in history to exceed 400 miles per hour, and retired the trophy permanently for Britain. Those races weren't just glory runs. Mitchell was learning. Every one of those designs was a controlled experiment in how speed relates to shape. He developed a deep intuition about wing thickness and profile and drag. He learned how to push engine and airframe forward together in partnership with the Rolls-Royce team. He understood by the early 1930s that the era of the biplane fighter was ending, that whoever solved the high-speed monoplane problem correctly was going to matter in whatever came next. Then in 1933, the doctors found cancer. Mitchell was 47 years old. He underwent surgery. Part of his recovery took him to Germany, where he attended a Luftwaffe air display. What he saw apparently shook him. Germany was rearming openly now. The aircraft on display were serious military hardware. He came back to England with a new urgency that went beyond trophies and contracts. The Air Ministry had circulated a specification for a new monoplane interceptor. Mitchell had already submitted a design under that specification, the Type 224, and it had been accepted. But it was an honest, conservative machine, thicker wings, fixed undercarriage, performance that didn't push hard enough. The Air Ministry liked it well enough. Mitchell didn't. He went back to the drawing board. He was working against two clocks now. One was the clock of German rearmament. The other was the clock the cancer had set running inside him. He knew it, his colleagues knew it, and he channeled that knowledge directly into the work. The new design took shape through 1934 and into 35. Mitchell's team worked out of the Supermarine offices in Woolston. Long days. A lot of argument over specific choices. And here is where the genius of the thing asserts itself, because the decision that defined the Spitfire more than any other was the one that made the engineers groan loudest.
The wing. Mitchell chose an elliptical wing planform. Look at a Spitfire from above or below and you see it immediately, those soft, perfectly balanced elliptical shapes tapering from root to tip. Beautiful. And it wasn't beautiful by accident. The elliptical planform produces the most efficient spanwise distribution of lift possible. It minimizes induced drag. It gives the aircraft a gentle stall characteristic, and it allows a remarkably thin wing section without losing lift, which means less drag at high speed. Aerodynamically, it was about as close to ideal as you can get. Manufacturing-wise, it was an absolute nightmare. Every single rib in that wing was a different shape from the ones next to it. No repeating geometry, no simple template you could run down the production line. Workers who had spent careers building biplanes with standardized parts had to learn to build something where almost nothing was interchangeable. The tooling costs were enormous. Each Spitfire took significantly more man-hours than a Hurricane. Mitchell's colleagues, practical production men, argued with him. He didn't budge. His argument essentially was this:
Get the design right first, figure out how to build it later. The prototype came together in a hangar at Woolston and was trucked to Eastleigh Aerodrome near Southampton. It was painted blue. It carried a fixed-pitch wooden propeller because the constant speed units weren't ready yet. The narrow undercarriage retracted inward toward the fuselage, a design that would give ground crews headaches for years. The cockpit was small. The forward visibility over that long nose was marginal. It was a close, tight, purposeful little airplane. And it was clearly extraordinary. Captain Joseph Mutt Summers was Vickers' chief test pilot. On April 5, 1936, he climbed into that cramped cockpit, taxied across the grass at Eastleigh, and flew the Spitfire for the first time. 8 minutes aloft, when he came back and shut down, those who were there remember him saying five words: "Don't touch a thing."
That line gets repeated every time the Spitfire story is told, and the context matters. He wasn't declaring the airplane finished, he meant, "Before I fly her again, don't change anything. Let me come back to this feeling exactly as it is." It was a pilot's reflex. When something is right in your hands, you feel it in your bones and you want to hold on to that feeling before the engineers start adjusting. Mitchell was at Eastleigh that day. He watched the flight from the ground. By all accounts, he was quiet about it afterward. Inward, you can imagine what was running through his mind. More than a decade of racing float planes and high-speed aerodynamics had led to this moment. He knew what this machine was. He also knew with as much certainty as a man can know anything that he probably wasn't going to live to see what it would do. He died on the 11th of June, 1937. He was 50 years old. The Spitfire was still more than a year from entering service with the Royal Air Force. There's a quote attributed to him, probably shaped by the telling over the years, that near the end he told a friend, "If Hitler ever gets into a war with us, just wait until they see our Spitfires." Whether that's the exact phrasing or not, it rings true. He understood the machine he had built and what it was going to mean. The name wasn't his, it came from Sir Robert McLean, the chairman of Vickers. Mitchell reportedly was not impressed. The phrase sometimes attributed to him is that it was just the sort of bloody silly name they would give it. History has forgiven them both. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Spitfire entered service with No. 19 Squadron of the Royal Air Force at Duxford in August of 1938. 8.30 caliber Browning machine guns and those elliptical wings. The Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, producing around 1,030 horsepower in its early form, would be developed continuously for the entire war, eventually pushing past 2,000 horsepower in the later marks. But at the start, this was what Fighter Command was bringing to the table, and then came the summer of 1940. France had fallen in June. The British Expeditionary Force had barely gotten out through Dunkirk. German forces held the Channel coastline from Norway to the Spanish border. The Luftwaffe, confident from the continental campaigns, turned its attention across 20 miles of water. The plan was to destroy Fighter Command, clear the sky over southern England, and open the way for invasion. What stood in the way was roughly 700 operational fighters, Hurricanes, and Spitfires. The Battle of Britain ran officially from the July through October 31, 1940. The Luftwaffe sent over Junkers 88s, Heinkel 111s, Dorniers, escorted by Messerschmitt 109s and twin-engine 110s. Fighter Command's controller system, developed by Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding, used the Chainhome radar network and the Observer Corps to direct fighters to intercept. Pilots scrambled on short notice, climbing hard to reach altitude before the raid arrived. The Spitfire against the Messerschmitt 109, Emil, was a very close match. In some parameters, the 109 was slightly better, in others the Spitfire had the edge. The Spitfire could turn tighter. The 109 climbed better at altitude and had a fuel injection advantage that let German pilots push into a dive without their engine cutting out. The Spitfire's Merlin used a float-type carburetor, negative G, the kind of G U-pull pushing the nose forward into a dive, starved the carburetor of fuel. The engine would cough and cut. For a critical second or two, the Spitfire pilot was without power. A German pilot could point straight down and his Daimler-Benz kept pulling. Spitfire pilots learned to half-roll before diving, which cost precious fractions of a second when fractions of a second could get you killed. The fix came from a Royal Aircraft Establishment engineer named Beatrice Schilling. She designed a simple diaphragm restrictor, a small washer with a precisely sized hole in it, that was fitted to the carburetor float chamber and substantially cured the problem. It was officially an RAE flow restrictor. Pilots called it Miss Schilling's orifice, with great affection and considerable impropriety. The Battle of Britain produced a threat nobody had fully planned for. In September of 1940, the Luftwaffe bombed the Supermarine factory at Woolston in Southampton. They hit it hard. Spitfire production was severely disrupted.
Lord Beaverbrook, who ran aircraft production for Churchill's government, arranged for manufacturing to be dispersed across dozens of small facilities throughout southern England. Bus garages, requisitioned buildings, small machine shops, each producing components that were assembled at dispersed final assembly sites, improvised and chaotic, and it worked. Around the same time across Britain, communities were raising money to buy Spitfires. Each one cost roughly £5,000 to produce. Towns and factories and schools organized Spitfire funds. The Nizam of Hyderabad donated enough for an entire squadron. School children contributed pocket money, workers gave from their wages. Aircraft that carried names painted on their fuselages, paid for by subscription from a city or a county, carried a weight of meaning beyond their armament. The men flying them came from across the Commonwealth and from occupied Europe. Polish pilots who had escaped after the fall of their country, Czechs, South Africans, Canadians, New Zealanders, Americans who had crossed the border into Canada to join the Royal Canadian Air Force before the United States entered the war. Pilot officer Adolf Sailor Milan, a South African who flew with 74 Squadron and became one of the highest scoring aces in the Battle of Britain, wrote his 10 rules of air fighting, practical, unsentimental rules. Shoot from close range and only when your sights are definitely on the target. While shooting, think of nothing else. Brace the whole of your body. He flew a Spitfire as if it were an extension of his own nervous system.
The aircraft kept evolving after the Battle of Britain. The Mark V became the standard fighter through 1941. When the Focke Wulf 190 appeared over the Channel in the autumn of that year, it outperformed the Mark V badly enough that fighter command was genuinely shaken. The Mark IX, rushed into service in 1942, largely restored the balance. Each Mark was substantially different from the one before. Bigger engines, different supercharger configurations, clipped wingtips for better roll rate at low altitude, extended wingtips for high altitude patrol, tropical air filters for the desert campaign, bomb racks for fighter bomber strikes, photo reconnaissance cameras installed in place of guns, armor stripped, everything lightened from maximum altitude and speed. Some of the high altitude reconnaissance variants reached 50,000 feet. Places where the sky at the edge of the canopy starts to go dark and your oxygen mask is all that keeps you thinking straight. Flying a single-seat aircraft at the top of the atmosphere over enemy territory, alone with an engine and a camera. Over 20,000 Spitfires were built in total. They served with Britain, Australia, Canada, Poland, Czechoslovakia, South Africa, the Soviet Union, France, and others. They flew from aircraft carriers as the Seafire variant, with its own story of folded wing routes and deck landing hazards, and a remarkable combat record. The last RAF frontline Spitfires retired in 1954. Some air forces flew them into the 1960s. Right now, more than 70 Spitfires are airworthy around the world. The Battle of Britain Memorial Flight at Coningsby keeps several flying. Private owners have spent years and fortunes restoring others from hulks. Some pulled out of Burma, some recovered from underground storage in Malta where they were buried to protect them from bombing. Each one is a separate act of long dedication. And when one of them goes overhead at an air show, something happens. People stop talking. They look up. That howl the Merlin makes on a fast climbing turn, rising and falling as the aircraft banks away, dopplering down as it heads out. Old men who flew them say things they don't usually say. Young pilots, who've never been near one, get very quiet.
That is what R.J. Mitchell built. A man who knew he was dying, who sat in Southampton and looked at what was gathering across Europe and said, "This design isn't good enough. Start over." He got it right. Worried about production later, never saw what it did. Alfred Price wrote what many consider the definitive technical history of the type. The Imperial War Museum and the Royal Air Force Museum hold the primary materials on Mitchell, Supermarine, and the Battle of Britain squadrons. RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger.